Sebastian Barry, congratulations on winning the £25,000 Costa Book Prize. Tell me how you're feeling about it.
Well, I feel delighted, and you, when you just mentioned that sum of money. I feel very thrilled. It's last night. I was talking to Mark Lawson at about 12:05 this morning, and he looked at his watch and said, "Oh, it's yesterday. That's yesterday's news now." Just teasing me. But so we went back to, went back to the hotel, and I have been sort of awake all night just wondering at these incredible things that can happen even when you're 53. And the delight remains this morning. Yes, indeed.
So you've won £25,000, but in a way you lost £25,000 because you could have won the £50,000 Booker Prize back in October. Yeah. So any regrets?
No, I think there are great lucks in life, and one of them as a writer is to have another book to do, and that is what to make a book, to get a book at all, to find a salmon in the river and fish it out and have a look at it and return it to the dark water is such a miracle in itself that's, and you have to accept the narratives that happen to narratives. Every book has its story. I published a little book called Annie Dunn in 2002, and after 6 weeks or so, that was it. We had the beautiful reviews and then we all went home. And we had a wonderful time with A Long, Long Way. That didn't win the book. We were on the shortlist, it didn't win, but it won. It had other experiences and other narratives. So, there is a delightful fact in a way that a couple of months ago, I didn't win the Booker, but a wonderful young writer called Aravinda Diga did.
So why didn't you win the Booker? There's some speculation in The Guardian that it was because, there were too many Irish novelists winning the Booker.
Yes, and I think that would be a good complaint, speaking as an Irishman. Strangely enough, I did bump into Anne Enright, who's a very old friend, and she was very upset about that. She took it as sort of something she had done to me, which was mad, of course. But people, it is interesting that after these, great events, these strange events, in many ways, there's a lot of fallout and there's a little bit of gossip and there's a lot of stories that accrue, which I think is part of the richness of our literary culture. It's become even more open and blatant than it ever was. I mean, judges freely tell the listening world, the world agog to hear what happened in the judging room. I don't think that ever used to happen.
Well, that was amazing. Matthew Paris saying that not many of the judges didn't like the ending. That almost destroyed the book for them. Mm. And for them, it was saved by the central character, Rosanne McNulty's voice of transcendence, he described it. I mean, when you heard that last night, what were you thinking?
Well, he said that in his opening remarks, and I did turn to my wife because I was very worried to put her through yet another endurance test like that. I said, Ali's not us, so we'll enjoy the chocolates and drink our coffee, and we'll go back to the hotel. And I whispered the same thing to Stephen Page. So it was a double delight then when one's name was eventually said. I think that's part of their job now. I think reality television has opened up everything in such an extraordinary way that some things are no longer secret. But I think it also creates hostages to fortune for people. It's a complex issue, that sort of secrecy and privacy and confidentiality. But I think it's the world we live in. And as only a sort of visitor to this world, I accept it. I look on at it and wonder at it.
So what do you think of what he said? I mean, we clearly can't talk about the ending because, as you're saying, it's a kind of a Dickensian ending and it's a plot twist which we can't disclose. But did you have any compunction yourself about the twist at the end?
If that's what they're talking about, because I'm not sure what they're talking about, because you can't assume. But I know that was the Ithaca of the book for me. Cavafy said, if you're disappointed in Ithaca, Ithaca gave you the journey. Without that, because that had to be concealed, it's something almost beyond my own abilities to conceal something within the body of the narrative, because in the main narrative of the book, that simply couldn't be the main thrust of the book. There were other fish to fry, as it were. So it had to be concealed. But at the same time, the germ of the book, it was a real woman, whose name I still don't know, who was my great aunt. And I felt if I was going to call her up from, her sorrow and her happiness and give me that book, I most certainly had to give her something at the end. And that was the feeling. And aiming towards that, in a way, released the rest of the book. in a curious sort of way, because that was the destination, and the journey then came with greater ease. So I'm completely indebted to the ending. People in America, strange enough, have no problem with it. I think the fact is that Dickens, and I was reading a lot of Dickens, and I was watching Bleak House, and those incredible moments in Bleak House that are quite implausible, but very poetic and theatrically correct. And of course, I am a person of the theatre. And I was reading a lot of Anderson. This was for a little play I was writing for Max Stafford Clarke. So it was as if I was, because my brain doesn't work past, present, and future. It's just all present. And I was intrigued by those things. And I thought it would be not only of great use to me to employ an ending like that, but of great use to Roseanne, that it would be the means by which I could give her something back.
And the means by which you could give something to your aunt?
In retrospect, no. I mean, the book is wholly invented. It's wholly fictional by necessity almost, because nothing is known about it. So it's entirely invented. At the same time, there's a mix in my own mind between reality and fiction in the book. So much so that, say, this great uncle who had his marriage with her annulled did marry again and had children. And the children of that family, of course, I was a bit concerned I didn't want to upset them, even though they would know immediately it was entirely invented. But the son of that marriage, who's now in his 60s, read the book and he rang me from New York. And he said, you know, I'm so glad you wrote this. And I know that lady's name is written on a piece of paper. And when our father died, he said, we were all so shocked because we didn't know he'd been married before. And her name is on a piece of paper. And I'm going to come over in the summer, Sebastian. I'm going to find you that name. And that is what, you know, the ending involves, a piece of paper with a name written on it. And it's this... And that's intensely Dickensian 19th century. But what happened to that sort of writing, and also Thomas Hardy, of course, famously Tess, vigorously objected to the ending of Tess. And, of course, famously was the Gladstone of Disraeli who threw little Nell out the window of the train. But Dickens famously would change endings. If John Forster, his friend, told him that that person should die, really, you know, or that person, and he would change it, but he would never change those things, because even if they divide opinion or divide your readers, it becomes so part of the book that to disentangle it would be a sort of violence to the book. At the end of the day, you write the book to the utmost of your powers at that moment in your life, and you know, in some ways, the flaws or perceived flaws in the book. Are the way, you know, statues lose their arms in time. You know, nothing's perfect. They're made by imperfect people. I realized when I conceived the ending, I think as it came to me one day in my workroom, I realized some people wouldn't like it, strangely enough. I hoped everyone would like it, but I thought there might be some, because I'm very aware of how old-fashioned it is. But I couldn't live without it. And in a way, I think Roseanne couldn't live without it.
Like Aravinda Diga's book about modern India, your portrait of your homeland, of Ireland, is hardly one that's going to endear to the tourist board. You know, it's a very bleak, unremitting story, as was Anne Enright's Booker winning The Gathering. Why is Irish fiction so miserable?
I'd love to say it isn't, but yes, except Roseanne, the character in the book, itemizes her happiness. She's very interested in happiness. And she was a joy to be with, you know, as a writer. She's like the ultimate pure writer. She doesn't even want anyone to read what she's writing. And she's trying to access the parcels of happiness that she was given. Bleak things have happened to her, but she hasn't created those bleaknesses. She hasn't indulged in them, or she hasn't even been responsible for them. And she loves the world, and she loves the progression of the flowers in spring from white to yellow to blue. She's very aware of these things. She loves the maid who throws out the crumbs for the birds in the morning down below that she doesn't even, and she never sees the maid, she just sees the hand. You know, these happinesses that actually are what is called mental health. Because we, you know, we are obliged by the psychiatry to smell the roses and relax and have a good time. And she knows how to do that. In a way, she's an exemplar of happiness. So I don't think it's a miserable is the book in that sense. But one of the consequences of the beautiful peace between, say, Ireland and England, is it's taken some of the pressure off our history. We no longer are saying, perhaps to too great an extent, this is what was done to us. And I think we have a compulsion, or I do anyway, to go back and see what we did to ourselves, especially after independence. and the people who lost out by independence, and those mistakes that were made, because the desire to have a holy Catholic Ireland after independence. Now, I'm a Catholic myself, my wife's Protestant, but it caused such damage to the creation of the country and was so against the original principles of, say, Wolfe Tone, who wanted a country for everybody, that Protestant, dissenter, Jewish, whatever, would all come together, forget our history, and have a new country. And that's what it was supposed to be. And traducing that caused enormous griefs, and hidden griefs, and griefs that are never seen. I mean, writing about the Irish soldiers in the First World War, in some ways, was an easier task, even though that was very forgotten too, than trying to find a woman like this, so marred in history, with no statistics, and most of the records in these institutions long gone, long eaten by the mice, and sometimes for good reason, as far as the people who owned the institutions would, you know, that would be their intention. Things had to disappear, and with it, your own people, you know, and because in a sense, you know, Einstein has told us that time is all in the same moment, and there, you know, it's in sort of an illusion. This thing, you know, it's always happening. We're always doing things to the people, and if you go back and retrieve them, then you're doing something in the present. You're at least acknowledging, even if it's uselessly, what they endured, and it's a sort of retrospective handshake, a sort of retrospective apology in some way, and that's maybe why there is this element of there's this extreme bleakness in Irish writing, because we've been dealing with bleak legacies. We've been dealing with the horrors of what some of the priests have done in Ireland, and you know, to our babies, and that's just intolerable. And
well, I think the odd thing for me as an Englishman reading this book is that I'm so utterly ignorant of certain aspects of my country's role in your country's history. For example, I didn't know that the hangman Pierpoint, which you referred to at one point, came over in the 40s and hanged some IRA men.
Well, incredibly, De Valera had him over. I mean, it was the beginning of the war, and he was terrified, of course, quite rightly, that if he didn't suppress his former comrades, who were still dissatisfied with what had been achieved by that form of independence, he was afraid they'd use the war to foment, you know, trouble and rebellion in Ireland, and you know, it's one of the multiple ironies. Are there anything else except ironies in the fire of Irish history? But so he actually got, you know, the imperial executioner over to dispatch a man who had killed an Irish policeman. And that when I read that, it really knocked me back. Also, when I was reading about the Blitz in Belfast, which I think is poorly understood in the South, the fact that it revealed the terrible injustices in the North, because the people in the inner city of Belfast, which was bombed, it was a great crown of fire that burned the heart out of Belfast, and the people fled out into the countryside. And there's incredible descriptions of them coming in, being taken in by farmhouses, and the children, as in their phrase, were not house trained. People were just peeing on the floor, and there was this sense of this enormous neglected and forgotten population in the city under unionism. This was the great mass of Catholic people, and this event uncovered this, you know. And I was just reading that and thinking, my God, Ireland, where is this country? What citizen? What place am I a citizen of? You know, and the wonderment of those things. But this is why Dr. Green was so important to me. Dr. Green has a sort of semi-autobiographical character to him, but he is that classic, what we used to call plastic Paddy. He's of Irish extraction. His parents were Irish, but he was adopted into England. He's from Padstow, and like you say, you know, I mean, in his bedroom, beside his wife's side of the bed, there's books about roses. On his side of the bed, there's books about Irish history, because he's trying to do what you're saying, is catch up with what he is. And I had that experience as a little boy coming over to Hampstead. It just spent a few years at an LCC school in Hampstead. They don't even exist anymore. And when I went back to Ireland, and with a little London accent, you know, I was beaten up in the schoolyard, and I had to learn really quickly how to be an Irish person, which I already was. But in a way, I wasn't anymore, and in a way, I've never quite become. That anxiety and fright, in a way, still exists in my. And in a way, my work, if I think about it, just thinking on the hoof here, sitting down, it is sort of an effort to escape that beating, in a sense. Because I have the same difficulty with Irish history, with knowing enough about your country. We grew up sort of middle class family in Monkstown, which is a very remote little district in South Dublin, very self-contained. And I don't think I spent enough time understanding what was happening in the north. And I didn't realise that you could understand the north through what had been the terror in the south just a few decades before. And so I've sort of come to it late. But in that sense, it's read to me like a novel, like a story. You know, what Roy Foster famously calls the story of Ireland. And there's so many of them.
Thank you very much for that.